This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
The Conservative Party they joined is not the Conservative Party it is anymore. I think they are no longer fit for purpose. I think they have essentially betrayed every single one of the people who vote them in. They are floundering around looking for a direction as they consistently replace leader after leader after leader with no concrete policy, no goal at this point.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, it was revealed that hundreds more homes are being planned in a scenic part of Medway. New Kent County Council buildings finally got up and running after May's elections. And one of the county's MPs reacted to the report into how mortuary monster David Fuller was able to carry out his horrendous acts. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. And I'm joined by Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who will be talking about what's happening at Westminster.
Hello.
And a little later, we'll be talking to Ellie Hodgson, a reporter who has some more exciting news about Kent Online's Blue Badge campaign. And this week's guest is Reform Councillor Oliver Bradshaw, who represents Maidstone Central at Kent County Council. Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
So I actually revisited an old planning application that I first covered quite some time ago for a massive solar farm and battery storage facility near Tyler Hill, which is a village pretty close to Canterbury. At the tail end of last year, a firm called Renewable Connections put in a planning application to build on the site, which is about the size of 80 or so football pitches spread across a load of different fields. I was expecting it to be decided at a planning committee at some point, but it was actually approved on delegated authority by council planning officers.
And how much power is it set to produce?
So according to the plans, it's going to produce up to 38 megawatts, which is enough to power about 15,000 homes a year. It's also worth pointing out that that's quite a normal size for a solar farm, sort of 35 to 49.9, because anything over 50 megawatts you have to get government permission for rather than the local council. So they've managed to get this through quite quick for its size. But as well as the actual panels, they're going to be building a battery energy storage system, which basically looks like a big row of shipping containers used to store renewable energy. And they said that the capacity for that storage will be about 30 megawatts.
Okay, and any idea when it's going to be up and running?
Last thing we knew, they wanted construction to start late this year and to have it up and running by 2026. So I guess we'll see if it all goes to schedule. It should be running probably this time next year.
Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
Following on from the local plan story, which I spoke about a couple of weeks ago, we're already starting to see the impacts of the draft proposals as a public consultation has been launched for a possible development of 750 homes off Pump Lane in Raynham on land which was designated for residential development, but with some significant caveats.
Okay, and tell us a bit about these conditions, because there have been attempts to develop the land before, haven't there?
Yes, the site in Raynham was previously the subject of an application for 1,250 homes, which was rejected by the council in 2020 and then appealed. The council defended itself and won the appeal and managed to prevent housing being built there. So when it was designated for residential development in the draft local plan, many were a bit confused. Although it has been earmarked for housing, the caveats include that any future development can only be provided by a small to medium enterprise developer in an attempt to prevent proposals which cram in as many houses as possible. Additionally, any scheme must include a nursery, land allocated for a primary and a secondary school, and a community centre, a health hub, a care home, and space for a convenience store to serve the new community. With all this in mind, Esquire Developments Limited are hosting two public consultation events on July 21st and 31st between 1pm and 7pm at the Oast Community Centre to get the public's views on proposals they are preparing for submission to Medway Council.
Have you spoken to the locals about this?
Yes, I have, and while some were a bit more hopeful that the conditions could mean a development which makes less of an impact on roads and other infrastructure in Raynham, many others said there are already enough problems that more housing will only make it worse. In particular, residents said the roads are gridlocked and more houses were reducing the amount of green spaces all around.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
Simon, Kent County Council is back up and running after the May election. What's going on at County Hall?
Well, you're right. The committees are up and running and electing their chairs. One of the most interesting is the scrutiny committee, which is seen as one of the most important and is to be chaired by the Liberal Democrat sort of deputy leader, typically opposition leader, Richard Streatfeild. And his vice chair will be Alistair Brady of the Labour Party. And this is pretty significant appointments because Reform has allowed such an important committee like scrutiny to be chaired by someone who's not a member of the ruling administration. The scrutiny committee really gets its teeth into the detailed decisions and asks some serious questions about what the Reform administration will be doing.
Why are these significant appointments?
Well, these guys are generally very good and are delving into the detail of papers that are presented to the opposition members, and they think of questions that many people wouldn't, other people wouldn't think of asking. They're both very intelligent and they're also likeable and generally well-liked by many of the members. And it does say something about Reform, the fact that they are prepared to allow two members of the opposition into those positions. It kind of says to me that despite the bluster of the first few weeks of the new administration, Reform will welcome some examination of the things it does.
Is there anything else happening?
Well, the council feels like it's back in action again, although there was some disquiet about the way the full council was conducted last week. But there's a general acceptance that the Reform Council committees are working okay because of the election run-up, Purdah and the rest. There's been very little business since March. But apart from that, KCC has put a collection of artworks up for sale this week, and they feature some pretty lesser-known artists, it has to be said, and it was hoped that it might raise about £45,000, but I don't have the actual final amount from the auction. This wasn't actually a Reform idea, hasten to add, but something that the previous Conservative administration had already put in train before they were booted out in May. Nikki, what's going on with your MPs in Kent?
It's more about what's going up in Westminster at the moment. A horrific case which hit the headlines a few years ago has been back in the news this week, and that's the story and the subsequent fallout of David Fuller. Now, he sexually abused the bodies of more than 100 women and girls in hospital mortuaries, including at Tunbridge Wells Hospital in Pembury, where he'd worked in maintenance since 1989. Now, those crimes came to light after he was linked in 2020 to the murders of Wendy Nail and Caroline Pearce in two separate attacks in Tunbridge Wells in 1987, for which he is also serving two whole life sentences.
So why is he back in the news then?
There's been a long-running independent inquiry taking place, which was announced back in 2021, and that's looking into the issues raised by this case in a bid to find out what went wrong and how we can stop it happening again.
So what's the latest on it?
Well, this week, phase two of the inquiry was published, and as you can imagine, it makes quite grim reading. Now, the first phase looked specifically at Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells Trust, where Fuller had worked, and that was to establish how he was able to commit these offences and remain undetected for so long. That was published back in November 2023. The second part of the report, this has looked at the wider national picture of how we care for the deceased across England. Now, what inquiry chairman Sir Jonathan Michael found was pretty shocking, and he's made a total of 75 recommendations. He says the current arrangements in England for the regulation and oversight of the care of people after death are, in his words, partial and ineffective. And he said that in significant areas, they're just completely lacking. Now, crucially, he feels that at the moment, the offences carried out by Fuller could happen again. Now, this evidence was gathered from 4,500 funeral directors, 204 NHS trusts, 317 local authorities, 200 hospices, and more than 14,000 residential and nursing homes. So this was a real in-depth investigation. Sir Jonathan said the weaknesses found at Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells NHS Trust were not confined just to that organisation. And he's found concerns in both hospital and non-hospital settings across the country. His main recommendation out of that 75 is calling for statutory regulation to be introduced, which remarkably doesn't exist. And that will be to protect the security and dignity of people after death, whichever setting or institution they're in.
So what happens next then?
Well, now phase two has been published. The government has said it will respond to the entire report and its recommendations. But in the meantime, Tunbridge Wells MP Mike Martin, he's been sharing his thoughts. Now, he said the clearest lines in the report to him were where Sir Jonathan said leaving things as they are, which he described as a patchwork quilt of varying qualities and no standards. It could just mean a repeat of Fuller's crimes. Now, Mr. Martin said he felt that as we move towards implementing those national recommendations, that should help people gain closure, because it's about being safe in the knowledge that this isn't going to happen again.
Okay, thanks very much, Nikki. Welcome, Ellie. You were up in Parliament yesterday. Tell us all about it.
Well, so yesterday, Kent Online's Blue Badge Battle campaign was debated at Westminster Hall, with the government agreeing to discuss possible changes. So I was there with Sandy Burr, a cancer patient who prompted the whole campaign, and it was there to watch MP Helen Grant present the issue of Blue Badge eligibility for cancer patients and those with life-altering illnesses. Tris Osborne and Dr. Lauren Sullivan also spoke up on behalf of their constituents to explain why the Blue Badge system needs reconsidering. So the debate allowed an opportunity to highlight the significant challenges faced by those unable to obtain a badge for a time-limited medical condition. And the outcome was the Under-Secretary of State for Future of Roads, Lillian Greenwood, admitted she is open to the possibility of change. So in a nutshell, she reiterated that the system does need to be fair and consistent, and that it should never be heartless or cold or feel like an obstacle course.
That's interesting. Very much of a cross-party consensus for this in Kent.
Absolutely. So obviously there's all 18 MPs backing the campaign. And yesterday there were some really important points that came out of the meeting that I think are worth mentioning. So the Minister, Lillian Greenwood, she reiterated that local authorities like Kent County Council and Medway Council do have powers to introduce locally determined parking concessions, such as the one we are asking KCC and Medway to introduce. And obviously only last week, Medway Council's leader, Vince Maple, signalled his support and said that local authority officers are currently looking into what more could be done to help those affected. And obviously, although we haven't yet heard back from the KCC leader, Lyndon Kemp-Caron, obviously Councillor Maple has invited KCC to the meeting and says it will be sensible to have a coordinated approach across the councils.
They always say that when you want to try and get a law change, that you the more numbers you have, the more cross-party it is, the better chance you have of achieving it.
Exactly. And even yesterday during the debate, we were joined by MPs from outside of Kent as well, just to show how important it is that although this is a Kent campaign, the policy needs to be changed across the board. And obviously, cancer doesn't have regional boundaries. It affects people across the country.
Listen, well, it sounds like it's going really, really well, Ellie. So keep up the good work and see you next time.
Thank you.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Just over 2 months ago, Reform UK swept a power at Kent County Council, taking 57 of the 81 seats. Among them was Oliver Bradshaw, who represents Maidstone. This week, Oliver was selected as the chairman of the Health Overview and Scrutiny Committee, one of the most important committees sitting at County Hall, and he joins us now. Oliver, welcome. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure.
No problem. Thanks for agreeing to speak to us. Well, a couple of months in, how are things going at County Hall?
I think they're going fantastically, actually. Of course, it's been a bit of a learning curve because some of the councillors are, well, this is the first time a lot of us are actually getting into politics the first time, especially at the level that is county level, but it's been going excellently. Everyone's having a great time. Me personally, this is the best job I've ever had, in my opinion. Getting to know my local constituents, getting to go out and see them, help out, it's amazing.
Touching on some of your background, I mean, you're one of the younger members elected to KCC in May. How old are you?
I am 23.
23. When did you first become interested in politics?
I've been interested in politics since I was quite young. My grandfather was the Maidstone Borough Council and also Parish Council. He represented the Beresford area. Mm-hmm. And I have very fond memories as a young child going around helping him put leaflets through doors in Beresford and, you know, be with him when he knocked on doors and spoke to constituents. And it's something that's kind of stayed with me since then. My family was very, you know, politically switched on. So it's making sure I knew, you know, what politics is, why we vote, how we vote, what I'm voting for, et cetera, et cetera. And so I've always been very much politically minded.
I wanted to ask, have you, a lot of people in Reform previously been members of other parties, or young people in politics tend to switch parties quite often? So, well, no, you've been a member of another party, or was it Reform that brought you into it?
I was a member of the Young Conservatives from when I was 16, and I did actually previously stand for the Conservative Party in the 2023 Maidstone Borough Council elections.
Which ward did you stand in?
That would be the High Street ward.
Okay, so that was quite difficult to win, though, wasn't it?
Oh, you know, it was a very difficult ward, but it was that was my first entry into, you know.
Yeah, so that gave you a little bit of a practice run at it.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that experience?
How much hard work campaigning is, actually. I mean, I know I was a paper candidate for the Conservatives, So it was like, oh, yes, we're just going to give you some leaflets and just put them through doors, but you're not expected to like do a large-scale campaign. But I still think I took it quite seriously, and it's the, you know, going around and just even the act of putting leaflets through doors, not even knocking, was quite a lot of difficulty because it's just you and, like, well, I mean, I had one other person helping me. You've got a lot of people to visit, a lot of things to do. It's a lot of walking.
Yeah.
Which I think people don't really realise.
They don't really realise, doing it. How many houses are in a single ward? I mean,
it was also, during the 2023, it was also, I mean, Mr. Sunak was, let's say, less than popular. So at the time, when people did see me putting leaflets through doors, it was a little bit of, Tory insert swear word here if they came out of their house. So you got used to it very quickly. You got used to not abuse, but people just, voicing their opinions at the party.
So, okay, obviously that election has come and gone. It's 2025, and you've been elected to Kent County Council. But why did you decide to join Reform? Did you think that the Conservative Party sort of lost its way a bit?
I joined Reform, essentially, as you just said it, the Conservative Party is no longer what I joined up for. It's the same reason that my grandfather and my grand defected. They said the Conservative Party they joined is not the Conservative Party it is anymore. I think they are no longer fit for purpose. I think they have essentially betrayed every single one of the people who vote them in. They are floundering around looking for a direction as they consistently replace leader after leader after leader with no concrete policy, no goal at this point.
A year ago, Reform UK was pretty much nowhere in the polls, and now it is regularly the largest party in the national opinion polls. I think the last one I saw was 30%, and a good 8% ahead of the next, which was the Labour Party. What do you attribute this rise to? Is it just we're none of the above?
Losco is going to have to go to Nigel, because he is definitely a political fibre, and he knows how to do public speaking. He knows how to get people on his side. But also, I think we offer something that no other party does. We offer proper right-wing, proper conservative values, and we offer the proper party for the working man that Labour says it is. Labour, in all fairness to them, was, and now they're not. I believe that people are looking at us and going, oh, this party is actually offering what we want. This party is doing what we want, saying what we want to hear, and promising things. And as you're seeing, many of the counties up and down the country beginning to deliver things that we said we would do that the other governments have not.
If Nigel Farage wasn't the leader of Reform UK, where would the party be?
I think that when Nigel came back before the general election the other year, of course, it seriously boosted our poll numbers because he's a very popular figure. I think that if he was to, resign next month, and we've got a new leader, I think, yes, we'll probably take a slight hit in the polls, but I think we could easily recover because Reform UK is not just Nigel anymore. Reform UK is its own separate entity. And I think people would still very much support us on the policy standpoint and what we aim to do and what we push for.
It is very much Nigel Farage's party. I mean, he came up with the name, he formed it. You can't be serious in thinking that Reform could stand on their own 2 feet if he wasn't around.
I honestly think we could. As I said, I would not say we wouldn't take a hit in the polls because, as I said, he's very popular. I think if he resigned, next month, I think we would recover because we are not the same thing. Yes, he is a major part of the party, but we are still independent.
I interviewed Roger Goff a few weeks ago on the podcast, and I basically put it to him that Reform UK is now the Conservative Party, which he took great umbrage to. Do you think there's anything in that?
Oh, in saying that we are more Conservative than the Conservative Party, I completely agree. As I said earlier in the questions, I think the Conservative Party has abandoned its core values. The Conservative Party is no longer conservative.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I think we have become the Conservative Party that's that weird way.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. But you talk about those core values. What core values does Reform have that the Conservatives don't have anymore?
The Conservatives once spoke of, we'll get immigration under control. We want low taxes. We want low taxes and we want controlled immigration. Under the Conservatives, we've had some of the highest rates of uncontrolled illegal immigration this country has ever seen. And under the previous Conservative rule, we had the highest tax burden, I think, since the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
That is not something you would expect a Conservative government to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at Reform, we have a hardline immigration policy. We want a stop to the illegal immigration, and we want people to have low taxes. And in that sense, yes, we have become the new Conservative Party because we have the policies of conservatism, low tax and low immigration.
Yeah. I mean, depending on who you might talk to, it's generally accepted that your administration, the Reform administration, is going to find maybe as much as 130 million quid's worth of savings in the next year's budget. And you know, this is not caused by anything that you've done. It's just basically because of squeezed budgets and increased demand on services and the cost of providing them. I mean, how on earth are you going to find that sort of money, do you think? Where do you see that coming from?
When I first heard from the council officers, I think it's around £111 million we have to find this year. It was unfortunately,
but it could be more than that because there are overspends. Yeah,
as I said, we can't exactly plant a money tree.
Yeah,
I wish. A lot of the savings we have found. If you saw the speech from our leader Lyndon in County Council last week, we have already started to find some savings. For instance, we cancelled the move from Sessions House, which is basically County Hall, to Invicta House.
Okay, yes. So can I just pick you up on that one? But I understood that building's now under offer. You can't just sort of pull the rug from underneath the people who are about to buy it, surely, can you?
So my understanding is, actually, I thought the same thing. Of course, I'm not privy to all the information of how it was sold or when it was sold. So that is a question, unfortunately, for the upper members, unfortunately.
Lyndon said that was possibly worth, she was going to chalk that down as a £14 million win, yeah? Because
I think it was like £14
million. £14.2 million, yeah. So where else is this money going to be found?
So it's the move away from Sessions House. It's the net zero numbers. We have the 2050 net zero thing. The KCC is trying to move all of its fleet of vehicles to, you know, electric cars. It's going to say we've basically, you know, scaled that back, which should be saving us about £40 million this year, because it is my opinion, I think the opinion of many of the party, that while it's, you know, net zero and reducing carbon emissions is important, I do believe myself that yes, humans have a link to climate change. I think it is important to do common sense policies.
Okay.
And throwing money at the wall to try and make everything, you know, electric and decarbonize everything just costs the taxpayer undue money. And this will save us around £40 million in the next, I think she said, about 5 years.
It was interesting, actually, because I was listening to the scrutiny committee today and I can't remember who said it now. I think it might have been Councillor Eustace, but I could be wrong. And someone was saying that essentially, rather than simply cutting discretionary services, which is where the last administration went to try and find some of the shortfall that it needed to find, it was going to find ways of making the statutory services more efficient. How do you see that working?
So the main statutory services that cost KCC the largest amounts of money is adult social care and children's social care. So in children's, it's the homeschool transport, and adult social care is, you know, looking after people that need residential care home, nursing home care.
Just for the listeners, you know, adult social care takes about 70% of the entire KCC budget.
For context, we have a £2.5 billion budget for the 25-26 financial year. I think it is about 73% of that just goes to adult social care. So it's a large amount of money. People actually don't understand how much it costs us. But a lot of that, and I will blame this on the previous administration of KCC, a lot of that was what we found out was a policy of the open checkbook. It appears, and I might be wrong, but it appears that the Conservative administration of KCC didn't really have a budget. They just said, right, how much will it cost? Sign the checkbook and hand over the money. And of course, it led to overspend after overspend after overspend, which leads to, as everyone will know, more debt and more accruing of money we don't have. And in terms of making the services more efficient, it's looking at how can we get a better value for money on our contracts. So for instance, for the home to school transport, I think you were in the meeting yesterday, we had a discussion in the Children and Young Persons Education Committee about the 26-27 home to school transport scheme, where we're looking at moving away from offering it from, you know, just offering taxis and giving young people who qualify for assisted home to school transport training on how to use public transport services, better allocation of the pecuniary travel benefit, things like that. Because, for instance, the taxis cost us in the realm of £10 million a year. And of course, some children do need to take a taxi to school, but this is mostly aimed at the people over 16, so the 16 to 19 year old children who still qualify for some kind of travel assistance, but we want to move away from just giving them a taxi kind of thing.
I don't think anyone would doubt that there's, like the things you point out with home to school transport and social care, there are probably efficiencies that could be found. But surely there's a case to be made that a lot of the reason why councils in general end up paying such ludicrous fees for services is part of a condition of the market and outsourcing. It's, there are only a limited amount of care providers, only a limited amount of taxi companies. You have a legal responsibility to provide these services, and the council, yep. And these firms come forward and say, this is what we can provide you, this is what you pay for it. You have to pay it. This Department of Local Government Efficiency, it might be able to save a bit of money here or there, but surely at this point it looks a bit like the writing's on the wall. And, unless this Department of Local Government Efficiency has access to finance and economics skills, hitherto unseen before, surely there's a very big risk of Reform County Council having to declare bankruptcy come next March.
I don't think we're anywhere near having to declare bankruptcy in the sense of a lot of it is finding efficiencies and mistakes that were made by the previous administration.
Like 120 million quid worth of efficiencies when all the savings that have been touted in the past week or so. It's a decent amount, but it's less than 20% of what you need to save has mm-hmm. been devised. You need to come up with something very impressive to work out.
To be honest, I don't envy that team's work. They have an awful lot of very hard work to do and a lot of things to rifle through to actually find that money. But it starts with, we don't want to cut statutory services because we can't, for one, and we don't want to just start cutting discretionary services because, yes, we don't need to provide them, but also people like having discretionary services that we provide. So a lot of it comes from, where can we find, as I said, where can we find money in existing contracts? Where can we save money? Where can we get value for money? And a lot of what we're finding, as I said, around the homeschool transport is children over the age of 16, we no longer have a statutory requirement to, basically provide them a vehicle transport. We don't have to take them to school via a taxi. So we are able to say, okay, let's give them another way. If they do qualify for assisted travel, how can we get them not having to use a taxi and get them onto public transport? Okay. And as we discussed in the CYP meeting yesterday, it was, okay, we're going to have the transport teams or transport training teams where officers will go with children onto a bus at key times during the day and teach them how to use a bus. That sounds quite simple, but for some children, that is a very difficult thing to do. It's a very stressful experience to get on public transport. And I think that's, one, it saves us money because we're not paying for taxis. And two, it gives these children what I think are important life skills because using public transport is something we will all basically do at some point in our life. So learning how to do it is important, in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay, well, there's many of those who either stepped down or failed to get elected in May are saying that KCC will be bankrupt within a year. Do you think that's a fair comment?
I think that's completely untrue.
Do you think you're going to have to plunder the reserves to make the books balance this year like the council's had to do in previous years as well?
I don't think we will. Then again, I'm not privy to the internal economic situation at KCC because I'm not very high up the pecking order. But I am confident that as a council, we will not have to be plundering any reserves anytime soon. I am very confident the Dolge team is doing amazing work. And it's not even just them. It's also the individual cabinet members for each section are finding their own savings and efficiencies and value for money inside of the contracts that they oversee.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's going to be easy. Okay. It's going to be very difficult to find the money because we can't just plant a money tree and harvest it for 120-ish million.
Yeah.
But we've got to start somewhere.
Yeah. KCC, it may not even exist in 3 years' time mm-hmm. because obviously all four elected councils in Kent will be abolishing themselves and replacing them and be replaced by a smaller number of much larger local unitary authorities. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with your leader, Lyndon Cameron's scepticism about local government reorganisation?
I do. And I'm in the point where I understand why it's being pushed forward. I know in terms of bureaucracy and in terms of efficiency of bureaucracy, it will make it easier. We don't have, borough councils doing one thing, we do the other thing, and it's a bit of a messy bureaucracy. But in terms of the, let's say, finer details, I think the national government has failed on pretty much every level to plan this out properly. Mm-hmm. I've had the, let's say, displeasure of reading that lovely, massive white paper they put out the other year. And specifically the Kent part, and they have five models for Kent that split us up into four or five unitary authorities. And I think the way they've done it, they have not taken into any consideration specifically around the financials, because how are you going to divide the debt up? Because you have
Every borough council, every district council, and the city councils with Canterbury will have their own levels of debt. Medway has its debt, seeing as Medway is getting reabsorbed. How is that going to be divided out between the new unitary authorities? How is the budget going to be divided out? Because one of my main concerns, especially, is already today, East Kent has some of the highest social care requirements of the county. So what happens when we unitise? Well, East Kent's going to be lumped with all the social care requirements, and their budget is going to be under significant strain from social care needs. Secondly, there's the idea of we're going to have four or five different care bodies, four or five different administrative bodies around care and highways, four or five different licensing bodies. I just don't think they've looked at it and gone, this works. I think they've rushed it through and are now letting councils pick up the mess.
Well, at least politically, you can blame the government. It's a win-win for reform, really, isn't it? Because if it all goes south, then you can sort of say, well, it wasn't our fault. We didn't want it in the first place.
Yeah, we can sit there and blame the government all day. I mean, it's everyone's favourite pastime, isn't it? Blame the politicians. But we have already, well, Linden has already lobbied the government to push back the deadline. The plan we have to submit, I think, this November. We asked if we can put it forward to March next year. That was denied. And the problem is, this is coming. We can say we don't want it. We can say you don't like it. We can blame the national government as much as we want to. Local government devolution currently is still going to happen. Okay. And we have a duty to make a plan. And whether we like it or not, if we get it wrong, it's the residents of Kent that will suffer if this gets wrong.
Where do you see your own political ambitions lie? Do you fancy a seat in Westminster?
You know, I really don't know, to be honest with you, because
joining the Young Tories at 16 isn't the actions of an unambitious man.
No, I wouldn't say so. But I am I'm a student. I'm studying biology, and if you ask me what my ambitions were literally 6 months ago before I got elected, I'll say, oh, I'm going to, you know, finish my degree and I'm going to go hopefully work in the private or public sector with my STEM degree. That's been my, you know, life goal for quite a few years. And then suddenly it was like, oh, I was offered the chance to stand again. I didn't expect much of it. I won. So, okay. And now it's the level of, well, I have now as an elected member, I'm seeing the actual difference I can make. And it's nice to see the differences I can make. It's nice to get those emails saying thank you for doing the smallest of things, whether it's getting a hedge trimmed or helping someone with their blue badge. And I wouldn't say I have, you know, major political aspirations. I'm not gunning for a seat in Westminster. I think I will see how life takes me and go from there. Because I know politics can be a very fickle game. So I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket kind of thing.
Oliver, lovely to speak to you today. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
It has emerged that a two-year super injunction was lifted this week and soon became clear that thousands of Afghan nationals were secretly admitted to the UK after a data breach left tens of thousands at risk of being killed by the Taliban. But the whole farrago will cost the British taxpayer at least £6 billion. Dan, you've been taking a keen interest in this. How on earth did this all happen?
So basically, under the previous government, the previous Tory government in 2022, known but couldn't be reported, apparently, that an unnamed defence official accidentally leaked a list of the personal details of 19,000 Afghans who had in some way assisted the Western war effort in that country, putting them in danger from the Taliban government, which re-established control in 2021. There had been a court injunction against reporting that, but obviously this has come out and it's not reflected particularly well on the previous Tory government. As part of that revelation, it's also been revealed that the government had to establish essentially a secret resettlement scheme for people who are in danger as a result of the leaking of that list, which has seen 4,500 people move to Britain. Is expected to result in about 7,000 extra people moving to Britain total. And that's on top of the 36,000 that have already moved here through other channels supported by the government since the Taliban took the country back over again. And like I said, it's been reported, previous estimates said it would cost about £7 billion, the cost of supporting all these people coming here. The current government says that's outdated, but it's been reported elsewhere. The cost is probably going to be in the realm of at least £6
billion. Yeah, I think about Rachel Reeves and her £22 billion black hole. It certainly would fill a certain bit of that, wouldn't it? But that's the way it goes. Nigel Farage has had his own take on this, and I'm quoting from what he said, but he doesn't add any context to this. And he sort of said that many of them helped us during, these are the Afghans, helped us during our 20-year war there, and others were known to us for being, frankly, just bad people. Either way, it was decided in 2023 to airlift many of them out of Afghanistan, a process that continues to this day. We decided that 25,000 of the 100,000 should come to the UK, and amongst that number that have come are convicted sex offenders, and the total cost of the operation has been a staggering £7 billion. Now, he doesn't offer any sort of provenance to where he gets his information from. I mean, can you see where he's maybe sort of divined this narrative from?
Yes, yeah, so there'll be a temptation among some, you know, notably a lot of many politicians have been quite quiet about this week, but there'll be a temptation among some to write this off as basically racial bigotry, which I don't really think it is. Many of the people being brought back to this country will be people who served as part of the Afghan National Armed Forces, which were constructed essentially by the West during the Civil War in 2000s when we first intervened there. And it is well known that those armed forces were profoundly corrupt and violent. Yeah, sexual abuse and sexual violence against both civilians and other members of the military is profoundly widespread. There's a long-standing Afghan cultural practice called Bachabazi, which is essentially the sexual slavery of young boys on army bases. And there's a litany of literature and documentaries and academic studies which show that this kind of thing is extraordinarily common in Afghanistan. It's one of the most sexually repressive and conservative countries probably on the face of the earth in the way it in the way it treats women and that kind of thing. And there's figures by the Telegraph released not even long ago that showed that from 2021 to 2023, of all national groups in the UK, Afghans were by far the most likely to be prosecuted for sex crimes, and it's about 20 times more likely than the rate of prosecution among British citizens. So many people accuse him of fear-mongering, and he probably could have gone some way to explain where that came from, but he's not, it's not just bigotry, it's based on, unfortunately, facts about Afghan culture.
Nikki, just turn to you very quickly. What do the local MPs have to say for themselves about this?
Well, digging around on social media recently, they've been rather quiet on social media about this, but maybe that's no surprise given what a huge deal it is. Now, Sir Keir Starmer has stood up in PMQs and he said that these former Tory ministers have serious questions to answer over this data breach, and quite rightly so, given how many millions of pounds this is going to cost. Now, I'm not saying that the money shouldn't be spent. Of course it should. We've got 19,000 people who served alongside British forces and whose details were leaked. We owe it to them to keep them safe. But it's already cost millions of pounds. And by the end of it, they're going to say the final bill is most likely to be very much more than that. There's a lot of people who are going to be really angry about this money at a time when we're being told to tighten our belts and brace ourselves for cuts left, right and centre from all the services our councils and government provide. And here we see millions of pounds having to go on something that shouldn't have happened. I'm sure whoever is responsible for this breach is mortified, but we ought to be told how they've been dealt with. Now, Downing Street has not said whether the official responsible for the leak has faced disciplinary action, but they have at least revealed they're not in the same role anymore. There's a lot of talk about the super injunction. I mean, I understand why there was a super injunction in place while this was all going on. People's safety is paramount, and I do kind of get at the moment from what we know as to why it happened. But there's so many questions that need answering to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And one of the things that stuck out for me, they've said that the previous government apparently only learned of this breach on Facebook. I mean, what's that all about?
Dan, finally, who wins and who loses politically out of this?
Well, I think it's worth saying that I expect literally the only party who will outright question both the use of the money on this and the Britain's obligation to support people who serve longer armed forces is probably Reform. People are critical of the bureaucratic failure which resulted in the leaking of this information. But questioning the idea that we need to support people who served alongside our disastrously failed intervention effort in Afghanistan is quite taboo. And unfortunately, frankly, well, whatever you may think of it, I think it's probably quite popular. Many people in Reform could probably capitalise quite well if they say, bad luck, they supported our war effort. Why do we now have an obligation to tens of thousands of citizens of an extremely different country? Why should we spend $7 billion on? That's probably what Reform will say. And I think that message will be quite popular.
OK, folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Dan, Robert, Nikki and Ellie for their contributions, and to our special guest, Oliver Bradshaw. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. And you can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you then.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.